Shalom Aleichem, Chaver, welcome. This is the National Council of Young Israel. We welcome all the Rabbanim. We certainly welcome Rebbe to the call for conference call number 117. Thank you, Rebbe.
You're very welcome. Question one, I'm a young Rav, and this is the first time I have this Shaila. A couple lived together before they decided to get married. He was a yeshiva bacha who went off the derech, but now it's coming back slowly. Are there any changes in the Sidur Kiddushin that I should be aware of? I'd appreciate to walk through the Halacha L'maisa. Can they make Sheva Brachas on subsequent nights? The truth is, that's the biggest shaila, the Sheva Brachas on subsequent nights. Paskin Halacha, they can be Sheva Brachas on subsequent nights. If you look in the Pischei Tshuva and Ebenezer Simen, Samar Beis of Kotn Yud Aleph, based on the Chasam Sofer, since this is the, I'm assuming, this is Yeshiva Bacha, it's his first marriage, irrespective of the fact that he was living with his girlfriend before, this is being married for the first time, that's sufficient to create a Sheva Brachas obligation for 7 days after that marriage. The only other really serious question over here is how you fill out the Ksuba. Usually the Ksuba you write down Besul Tada for a first marriage. Clearly, she's not a Besul Tada anymore. There are two possibilities. I'm going to assume the better possibility, that she's only what we call in the Gemara a Bu'ulas Atzmo. That means she will assume for the moment that she had no relations with anybody in her life except for this boyfriend of hers whom she's now marrying. Such a case, there's another Pischei Tshuva in Simen Kuf Ayin Zayin Sifkot and Gimel. It's a Machloikis. You write in the Ksuba Besul Tada, or do you not write Besul Tada? And it seems to me that it's appropriate to write down Besul Tada, not to embarrass the scholar if the fact that she lived with this man is not so well known. It's permissible to write Besul Tada. What's the worst case scenario? That he's only obligated a lower level, technically speaking, but he knows that she's a Be'ula. He knows very well from his own personal experience. And therefore, if he wants to obligate himself to a greater amount of money of a ksubas besula, he's allowed to do so. Rav Moshe has a tshuva like that. Even if she was nivela to somebody else, to another Jewish person, and he marries her, and to avoid the embarrassment, he's willing to write down besula to her. Even that's allowed, how much more so in this case? Question number two. Purim, exactly to whom does the rule of kol haposhet yado apply to? Only a poor person collecting for himself, or even someone collecting for someone else? What about someone collecting for yeshiva or the mosad? How much minimally must be given? It's clear that kol haposhet only applies to the ani himself. You can't turn away an ani on Purim, but someone's collecting for somebody else? No. Collecting for yeshiva? No. A mosad? No. You want to give them money? It's very nice. That's not included in kol haposhet yado, because you don't really fulfill Matonas Levyonim in that fashion. Even in the case where technically for somebody else, it's not completely clear that the Poshet Yodah would apply. The Ani is not Poshet Yodah at all. Someone else Poshet Yodah would not apply. How much should you give? So the Ritva suggests to give a Shava Pruta, you can fulfill Matonas Levyonim. But others say, no, you should give enough to be able to afford a meal. How much does it cost to afford a meal? A bare bones meal of some challah with some meat, with some wine. I don't know, $5, $10. But most people give that much anyway. If someone comes to the door on Purim, that should certainly be sufficient. Question three. Is there a general rule of how to paskin when there's a machlokas between the Mishnah Berurah and the Aruch HaShulchan? What about when there's a machlokas in the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch and the Mishnah Berurah? The answer to both questions is no. There's no general rule. There are different gedolim who preferred in general, the opinion of the Mishnah Berurah, because he was the rabbi in Shulchan Yisrael, or the opinion of the Aruch HaShulchan, because he was a rabbi of a big city. The Mishnah Berurah was not a rabbi of any city, and he lived in a tiny place called Radin. There are different opinions as to who they prefer in general terms, but in specific shilas, where there are hundreds of disputes between these two giants. So there's no rule who we paskin like. The most prevalent rule of all is the Gemara's rule of Puk Chazi Mayama Dabar, which is see what people are doing. If most people who are medaktik in b'mitzvahs follow the Mishnah Berurah, So then the person, the Rav, who is paskening without his own personal view on how to pasken, just based upon what the Svarim say, I think he should follow what people are doing. If people are following Mishnah Berurah's psak in a particular case, he should pasken that way. Erech HaShulchan that way, Kitzur Shulchan Aruch that way. If he has it, if he's a Talmud Chacham who knows how to analyze the Gemaras and the Rishonim and the earlier Poskim on his own, so then he's entitled to his own opinion as to which of these three Gedolim, Mishnah Berurah, Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, and Erech HaShulchan, he wants to rule in accordance with. But if he has no such status, just going with the flow, so the primary flow is my Amad Dabar, what people are doing, which can sometimes be Mishnah Berurah and sometimes be Erech HaShulchan, on a case-by-case basis. Number four, on Shabbos, a woman with a sore throat suck on Luden's cough drops. Is it considered medicated or just like a regular sucking candy? Is the halacha different for Ricola's or Hall's cough drops? Go back to my earliest youth when I was in elementary school, so we used to have to wait in line for a bus in front of a candy store. And every day while waiting for the bus, I'd go and give a dime and buy a pack of Luden's cough drops, which I would consume by the end of the day. That was one of my vices as a 8-year-old. Whatever it was simply candy. Luden's cough drops is candy. And therefore, it's not at all a medication, even though it's called cough drops. Not even a shiloh. It's like a plain piece of candy. And you can have it on Shabbos for sure. For sure. Now, on the other hand, Ricola is not that way. People, to the best of my knowledge, will not take a Ricola cough drop unless they have a medical issue, a sore throat or something of this nature. Therefore, it seems to me, if my facts are correct, that Ricola, and maybe even Halls, I was told there's something similar to Ricola, would be problematic. If it's not what's called in the Gemara's expression and the Rishonim and the Poskim, Machal Briyim. Machal Briyim is mutter, even if you're doing it for medical reasons. You're allowed to take hot tea, hot chicken soup, even though you're really doing it to take care of your cold. Because it's Machal Briyim. Healthy people have chicken soup and tea. But I'm not sure if healthy people have Ricola or Halls. My information given to you is that the answer to that question was no. And if those facts are correct, that healthy people do not suck on either Ricola or Halls cough drops, then a person who has a sore throat should not take it on Shabbos. Now, I'm talking about a plain old sore throat, which is does not rise to the level of cholde she'ein bo sakana, that someone who cannot function normally. But a simple sore throat, let him have the Luden's cough drops, which are really plain candy, that will relieve some of his symptoms, but he should not take Ricola or Hall. Number five. The Mishnah Berurah writes that while a woman can be yotzei the mitzvah of Megillah by reciting it herself or hearing the Megillah from another woman, he says that women should hear the Megillah from a man. He specifically writes in Shaar HaTzion that a woman should not read publicly for other women. Seems to be a recent trend where some shuls have Megillah readings for women by a woman. In light of the Mishnah Berurah, is this okay? Of course it's not okay. The Mishnah Berurah says you shouldn't do it. It's enough of a reason that it's not okay. I must tell you that the reason the Mishnah Berurah gives it's not okay is, to me, I have to be intellectually honest, quite problematic. As a matter of fact, if you look in the Dirshu, footnote 25, he quotes the reason. The reason is Zila Milsa. It's not appropriate. And if Shlomo Zalman is quoted as saying, Zila Milsa only applies if a woman says something, does something publicly, in the presence of men, in the presence of women only, he doesn't see why it should be considered to be in the category of Zila Milsa. And for this reason, one cannot say definitively that there's a absolute prohibition of having such a Megillah reading by one woman for other women. It's the Mishnah Berurah doesn't like it because of Zila Milsa. Shlomo Zalman is not convinced that it's Zila Milsa. But I am completely opposed to this for a totally different reason, with the reason which I think the Mishnah Berurah could not have possibly imagined. And that is that when this phenomenon first began, by now it's already 40 years ago, this began, I said, the next thing you know, they're going to read the Megillah for a man. You'll say, what's wrong with that? Women are chayiv in the Megillah also. The Shulchan Aruch quotes from the Baal Halachos Gedolos, Siman Tov Resh Pei Tetz, Tiv Beis, that women should not read the Megillah for a man, because the woman's only chayiv in Shmiya, and he's chayiv in Kriya, whatever that means, not for now. And before you turn around, if a woman's going to read the Megillah for a woman, next thing you know, she'll read the Megillah for a man. We said this 40 years ago, both in the context of the Megillah, and what they call then women's tefillah, where women would read from the Sefer Torah for other women. And it didn't take long. I was accused at the time of being too concerned with the slippery slope. Sadly, we're already down that slippery slope for many years. Many, many years ago, certainly more than 20, maybe close to 30, it already happened that women started reading Megillah for men, and having what they call partnership minyanim, reading from the Sefer Torah for men. So sadly, we're down the slippery slope already. That's why I would say I would be very upset by any shul that is having this kind of a phenomenon of a women's Megillah reading, even if I'm saying to you that the Mishnah Berurah's reason for saying no is somewhat questionable. We have to be intellectually honest. Shlomo Zalman seems to be questioning it to some extent. But there's another reason I think it's much more significant. And this, of course, goes to the whole heart of the new practices that are being introduced, which sometimes they are, despite that there are certainly many women whose intention is Hashem Shemayim, but there are many others, sadly, who are interested primarily in feminism, egalitarianism, which is a very sad phenomenon. I'll just repeat to you very briefly what I said in my Shabbos Agadot Russia, I think it was 40 years ago, when this first came up, the women's tefillah. It's relevant to next week, the Purim. In Purim, it says that Kimu v'kiblu ayahudim. So the Gemara says in Masech the Shabbos, Kimu masha kiblu kvar, that we accepted upon ourselves the Torah again, even though originally it's Kofa kegigis modorabo l'raisa, hoda kiblu b'meach ha-shverish. It says, Kimu v'kilu ayahudim. Yes, the Maral Prague, finish the Pasuk. Kimu v'kilu ayahudim, aleim v'alzarim, yes, osim, samar bo'osar, etc. They accept upon themselves Purim. How can the Gemara and Shabbos say that they accepted the entire Torah? They only accepted Purim. This is the Maral Prague. There's no way you can accept something new without first accepting everything old. And I spoke about this 40 years ago, that sadly, the people who were instigating for these women's tefillah and later women's megillah were not even keeping some of the basic halachas that have to be kept by everybody, men, women, or women specifically. So they have no business taking upon themselves new things when they haven't yet been careful with the old things. Now, I'm fully aware that there are some women who are careful with all the old things. They're l'shem shemayim. However, but the facts on the ground indicate that the details are not being fulfilled properly. Many, many years ago, there was an article in Tradition by the Frimer brothers about women's tefillah, 100-something pages, and it had to do with Rabbi Shech the Shlita's response, and they had certain critiques back and forth. But that was only what they called theory. There's supposed to be a second article called practice. To the best of my knowledge, it was never printed. And if it will be printed, it will demonstrate beyond a shadow of a doubt that the practice is not in accordance with the halachas, even in the b'diyeva situation. There are violations of technical halacha, not just of the spirit of halacha. And therefore, I believe that this women's megillah is something which has to be discouraged, if at all possible. Next question, number 6. A pulpit rav is requested to perform a chasa for a kohen to a divorcee. The Kohen's parents were not Shomer Shabbos. Can the rabbi perform this wedding when the Kohen's chazaka of being a Kohen is suspect / questionable? Why is this chazaka suspect / questionable? The fact that a Kohen's father is not a Shomer Shabbos does not take away one whit of the kahuna of his son. And therefore, there's no way a rabbi can perform such a wedding. The only chance is when you say the parents were not Shomer Shabbos, you have to check carefully into the not to the man's history, but into the woman's history. It's very possible that a woman who's not Shomer Shabbos, who's maybe completely secular, perhaps if she was totally secular, and as a young woman, she was, for example, on a university campus for 4 years, depending on her age, because things got worse and are still getting worse as time goes on. Today, they call it the hookup culture, where there's promiscuity, the capital P, on all of these college campuses. And the possibility exists that this mother, when she was secular, lived with a non-Jewish man. If that is the case, the parents are not just not Shomer Shabbos, but they're completely secular, and she led that kind of a lifestyle, which is typical of university students or even other individuals at that period of time. And this happened presumably before she was married. We have to assume that even if she's not Shomer Shabbos, that she's faithful to her husband. We're not accusing her of adultery. But at the same time, before she was married, when premarital relations became de rigueur, already starting from the 1960s after the birth control pill, and it got worse in the 70s and 80s, you know, the mother of this so-called Cohen, we don't know how old the so-called Cohen is, how old the mother is, but if she had that experience, if it can be determined that that's what happened, then the son is really not a Cohen. He's what we call a cholol, which case such a wedding would be potentially permissible. Of course, you require evidence of some sort that this was in fact the case. But other than that, such a wedding may not be performed. Number 7. Is there a question about whether a letter in the Sefer Torah is a hey? Yes. Why does Halacha teach that we ask a child who recently learned his Aleph-Bet, not an adult like the Gabbai or the Rav of the Shul? Very good question. The answer is that the Rav or the Gabbai or anyone who knows the context of the particular letter or word can figure out what the letter or word should be based on the context. A person who knows what it says in the Holy Torah, he is smart enough to figure out it's either a hey or a ches, because he knows what it belongs. You show him, you know, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. So if you show him the letter between an aleph and a dalet of Echad, he'll know it's a ches. Right? If a hafta is Hashem Elokecha, you show him a letter between the vav and the vase of a hafta, he knows it's a hey. He's trying to get somebody who has no idea, he doesn't know what Vahafta, doesn't know Echad, doesn't know anything. He just knows what letters look like. He's the perfect person to determine whether it's a hey or a ches. Question number 8. At a cemetery, less than a minion is present, are they allowed to recite the Kaddish translated to English? Or do we posit that the Kaddish in English still requires a minion? This question was shown to me in a beautiful collection called B'Mar'ei HaBazak. It's put out by Eretz Chem in Yerushalayim. And it's like with the speed of lightning. Based upon questions they get from all over the world. This question, I believe, came from New York. They asked this precise question. And the answer was quite definitive and conclusive. The answer is absolutely no. They're not allowed. And the reason is very simple. You can't have it both ways. It says that we pass that tefillas b'chol oshem. A person can fulfill even Shema b'chol oshem tata shomeya. A person can fulfill his obligations of tefillah and of kriya shema in English. And if you can fill the mitzvah in English, then if you say kaddish in English, it's a legitimate kaddish, and therefore requires a minyan, just as it requires a minyan if it's said in Aramaic. Question 9. Our shul has an older Sefer Torah, which is kosher, however written with Ksav Beis Yosef. You recently received a newly written Sefer Torah, which was written with Ksav Ari. Being that there are poskim who would not make a bruch on a Sefer Torah with Ksav Ari, should we specifically use the older Torah for Parsha Zohar, or should we use a new Sefer Torah as it is in better shape? Of course, the answer depends who you ask. If you ask someone who thinks that the Ksav Ari is possible, as the Chazon Ish had suggested, then it's a no-brainer. You have to use the older Sefer, even though it's not so good. Most poskim reject that. Most poskim say that even if you prefer Beis Yosef, as we do, Ksav Ari is still kosher. And if Ksav Ari is kosher, and it obviously depends on the the discrepancy between the two Sefer Torah. If the Ksav Ari is just a tiny bit better than the Ksav Beis Yosef, I'd use the Beis Yosef. If the Ksav Ari is brand new and perfect, the Ksav Beis Yosef is ancient and really weak, could be even a real psul, you don't know, then it's better to use the Ksav Ari. So it all depends on the particular circumstances. Question number 10. Which Zman should be used for Sof Zman Tainus Esther, located in New York? Should we use this Zman for other Tanesim as well? In my shul bulletin, I never write the end of a fast. I write, it's a time for Ma'ariv. I know full well that the time for Ma'ariv, there'll be people, whether they're in shul, or more likely people who are out of shul, women or children, who will say, oh, it's time for Ma'ariv, it's just time I can break my fast. Therefore, we put in this man the time that is the smallest possible time that we feel a person should be able to break a fast, but not exactly best time to break the fast. So for example, the time that's written in my bulletin for Ma'ariv on the night of Purim, the night of Purim, that's a week from tonight, if I have it straight. So the sunset last night, I believe, 5:54. If I'm not mistaken, the sun sets, Tainus Esther, if I'm not mistaken, I believe it's, they moved the clock, it's a whole different story. I think it's 6:04, if I have it right. And we're going to dive in tomorrow, 6:35. If I have it right, maybe I'm off by a few minutes here or there. Could be, I don't remember precisely. The kids are half an hour after the sunset, we write down mincha. You know, we don't write threes or fours or twos or ones. We have it rounded off to the nearest zero or five. That's what we daven mincha, excuse me, daven ma'ariv in my shul on not only Tainus Esther, but all the other fasts. Except Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, we do it a bit later. Yom Kippur, we want to make sure it's at least, you know, like on Shmotzi Shabbos, because the period is break a fast that's much more serious. So we will have an average of 45 minutes, which means it will round it off. It can end up being 43, 4, 5, 6, or 7 minutes after the Shkia. That's what we call Ma'ariv for on Motzi Yom Kippur. If someone wants to eat at that point in time, I believe it's okay, even though Yom Kippur requires a Tosefis, which the other fasts do not. So it's a little bit later. It's approximately 10 minutes later for Yom Kippur. All the other fasts, maybe a little bit more than 10 minutes after Yom Kippur. The other fasts will daven Ma'ariv approximately half an hour after the sun sets. When is the fast over? Rabbi, when's it over? So when you get home, that's when it's over. By the time you get home, it's over, even according to a Moshe Shir of 50 minutes. A Moshe Shir, that's a Moshe Shir, of a Tetzel Chavim in New York. If you start davening 30 minutes after the Shkia, Ma'ariv takes 15 minutes. To get home, it takes 5 minutes. So Moshe writes 45 to 50. Should be have no problem whatsoever. Now, Tainus Esther is a little bit unique, because even someone who is not in shul, and therefore it comes to the other three fasts, they can have the other four fasts, they can certainly eat at home when the time comes. Tainus Esther is different. Why is Tainus Esther different? Because there are more paskins that I should not eat until you have to create some Megillah. Tough Reish Tzadi Beis Sif Dalit. So that's to be a little bit careful. It is true, if you look at Mishnah Berurah Sif Katan Yud Dalit, he says that's only to eat. But if someone's a little bit sick or weak, he can be Toeim. What does Toeim mean? Well, until this Kebetza of Pas, the size of an egg of bread or the bread equivalent, or drinking. How much can he drink? So if you look on the, it says a certain smaller amount. If you look on the Dirshu 27, that's only an intoxicating drink. But if it's water, drink as much as you want. So that's what we tell someone who is weak or sick. Otherwise, you should wait till after reading the Megillah. Question number 11. A woman asks if she can leave her oven on over Shabbos and immediately before Shabbos place a roast in the oven with the intent of removing and serving the roast for Shabbos day Suda. Is there a difference if it is fully uncooked or is partially or fully cooked? This is a great question. If it's fully cooked, there's no problem. If it's partially cooked, has to be what's called kamachal ben drusoi, which is either one half or one third cooked. It's hard to measure these things quantitatively. Many poskim say you count the quantitative shear of machal ben drusoi, which is either one third or one half cooked, based upon the time it takes to cook. So it takes 2 hours to cook. So machal ben drusoi is either 40 minutes or 1 hour, 60 minutes. Depends what shita. We can be making on the shita. This is the Rabbanon. So 40 minutes would be enough. But when do you start the 40 minutes? Chazanish says you don't start when it's ice cold. You start the 40 minutes when it starts to cook. Well, when's it called starts to cook? Yad soleta svo. It's too hot to touch. That's when it starts to cook. So if it's that, if it's reached that point, plus a third of the remaining time till it gets fully cooked, then it's called machal ben drusoi. And then we pass the halacha like the Rabbah and Shulchan Aruch, that's mutter to put it in even without any special blech. If you look in the Shulchan Aruch, it sounds that way, Rabbi Kiv Vega talks about it. That's the bottom line. However, if it's less than shir machal ben drusoi, not allowed. The questioner seems to be referring to a different heter called kedera chaisa. If you put in something which is totally raw and no way can be ready until tomorrow, then the post can say, we're not afraid you're going to stoke the coals or adjust the fire for Friday night. There's no way it's going to be ready for Friday night. And for Shabbos, there's no need to stoke the coals. It'll be ready by Shabbos morning. So therefore, they never made a gzera. Shema yachata b'gacholim. Very difficult to rely upon this cooler nowadays. If you look on the Dirshu, he talks about it in footnote 19, where he says that once it reaches Yad Soleta's bow, it's already usher, no longer called Kedera Chaisa. Look at the beautiful Sefer Piskei Tshuvos, footnotes 39 to 41, in Siman Reish Nun Gimel, says, Kimat v'lo shayach bizmanenu. Because we take in Shabbos early, and almost any cooking device can be put up to high and cook right away. The truth is, he gives an example of a slow cooker, or a crock pot, as a possibility. But it seems to me, if you put up your crock pot to the, usually these crock pots go from 1 to 5. If you put up to 5, it's very possible that it can cook more quickly and maybe even be ready for the night meal, maybe. So I don't know if it's a heter of kedera chaisa, even in a crock pot. But anything beyond that, seems to me it's almost impossible to have any kind of a heter. And since the Torah in the case of putting it in the oven, you don't put a crock pot in the oven. It's the oven. You put the oven out to 550, seems it can cook even a kedera chaisa in short order, and therefore the gzera applies, and therefore it's not allowed. Question number 12. One of the mispalim has both parents in stages of being unwell and has AIDS for both. It's a four-part question. A. What are the guidelines for using an aid in the house regarding cooking Shabbos, Yom Tov, and Pesach, etc.? B. Preparing them for Pesach will be a challenge to say the least, and their daughter can't start until a day or two before Pesach comes in because everything will get undone. What guidelines can be she follow in preparing for someone who sometimes is with it and sometimes not? C. They have multiple Gentile aides. Are they allowed to bring their food into the house on Pesach? If not, what do you suggest? D. They cannot have an open flame near the oxygen or the concentrator. I know what that is. I suggested relying on the Achiezer and using a flashlight with an incandescent bulb for Eish by Havdalah. Is there a better way to do this? E. I'm sorry, it's a six-part question. E. If one is incontinent, with the incontinence, there are times when the Reach Ra lingers after they have been cleaned up. Can brachas be made then? F. One parent is confined to a bed home They fall asleep mid Megillah and cannot remember by dementia to Megillah. Are they an onus? Do you wait till they wake up? Do you start all over again? Etc. All very sad questions, but real questions. Was these things really happen? Okay. So it seems to me that questions regarding King, Shabbos, Yontif, Pesach, everything is okay to a non-Jew because they have a status of Chol HaShein Bo Sakana. He said many times that a Chol HaShein Bo Sakana, anything can be done to a guy, even an Issa Daraisa. Of course, it's better to avoid if you can, but if you can't avoid it, you may do this. You may cook on Shabbos to a non-Jew, Yontif for sure, Pesach, you know, you have to make sure it's not chametz, but cooking would be permissible. Now, preparing the whole for Pesach. You know, people go crazy with Pesach preparations, and they do much, much more than they have to do. You do the best you can. It's worthwhile reading some of the writings. You know, there's a piece that Rabbi Scheinberg Zal said at one of his shiurim that stop with this. But the fact that the woman slaves herself to prepare for Pesach, she can't enjoy the Yontif. Simchas Torah is a mitzvah, could even be a daraisa, and all these chumash that are put on the balas havayis are incorrect and inappropriate. So here too, you follow the Ikar Adin. The Ikar Adin is you have to get rid of a kazayas of chametz. Even a small kazayas is still, you know, the size of an olive. Anything less than that, crumbs, etc. Strictly speaking, you don't have to clean up the house from crumbs. I'm not saying you should, but don't make yourself crazy. So therefore, the daughter should start more than a day or two before, doing the basics. And the last day or two, remove all the chametz from the house and make sure that no more chametz comes in. Now, see, what if the goyim bring in their chametz on Pesach? So, of course, they should try to discourage them from doing so. Try to encourage them to eat kosher the Pesach food in the house. Offer them matzah. What's wrong with matzah? If it's impossible and they insist on bringing in their chametz to the home on Pesach, it's not a chatchila, obviously, but technically speaking, if a guy brings his or her own chametz into the house, it's not a violation. You just keep it under wraps and make sure not to give it to anybody else, not that crumbs shouldn't fall. That would be okay. As far as Abdullah is concerned, there's a much simpler piece of advice. Just don't use a ner at all. It says in the Shulchan Aruch, Reish Tariches, ner Abdullah is only a reshus. Vein tzorach l'chazer achra. You don't have to look for it. You don't have it. It's a very serious question whether you're allowed to make a Abdullah now on an incandescent bulb. Number one, some of them are frosted. You can't really see the fire. Even if it's not frosted, it's a glass in between, which some say is a problem. So therefore, it seems to me that it's better do without it completely than relying on Reb Chaim Oizer, who said you could use an incandescent bulb just to demonstrate that putting on an electrolyzer, he said, there is. That's the reason he did it. Okay, and then we go to the fifth. The answer is, if there's a Reach Ra, one may not daven, may not say a bracha. You have to just walk away beyond where the Reach Ra goes. Can't help it. And finally, if they fall asleep in the middle of the Megillah, they can't remember, it's an onus. They're absolutely an onus. Just keep right on going, because whatever they can fulfill, they can fulfill. Obviously, this is limited to a case of someone who's dementia, who's falling asleep. Someone who is healthier, you read the Megillah, you have to make sure they stay awake the entire time. That's obvious. Question number 13. I came across several ceramic coffee mugs, Starbucks, at work, left behind by someone who was not working here anymore. We have microwaves and some percolators, but no treif tea or soups. They appear unused. Can it be assumed that at worst they were used for coffee, or should they be assumed to be treif? It seems to me that based upon the circumstantial evidence that these coffee mugs are kosher, and since presumably, you have to make sure that it's used when it's Eidah ben Yomo, and Stam Kem Eidah ben Yomo, they weren't used in 24 hours. I think it's permissible to consider them to be kosher. They appear unused. Okay, finally, 14. I sadly have been informed that a member's sister has been cremated. What should be done with the urn full of ashes? The Mispala asked if the ashes could be buried with her after 120 years. Any question about this, you have to go to the sources, Rabbi Elchanan Zon Shalita, who was the head of what they call NASC, the National Association of Chevra Kaddishas, also head of the Vad of Queens Chevra Kaddisha, with my own family has utilized his wonderful services, always coming in the middle of the night and all kinds of times. So he's the expert. He told me that it's a cherem akadmonim not to bury ashes in a Jewish cemetery. Can't do it. Can't do it. The ashes have no kedusha. The Gesher Chaim says you can throw them out. Nonetheless, if they want to bury the ashes, let them bury the ashes in a different place, either in a a non-sectarian cemetery, or even sadly a Reform Jewish cemetery where the people are not observant. If you want to save the money, they'll charge you for burial. You can bury the ashes in your backyard somewhere. I do it respectfully. But in theory, you can throw in the garbage. This is the sad answer to the sad question. Thank you very much.
Rebbe, we thank you very much. Bezrat Hashem, we can call upon Rebbe in the future. Have a wonderful Purim Yontif, and we'll be in touch, Rebbe. Thank you very much.
Call to. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.